Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. Anderson Nattinger will report on the recent convention of the Democratic Socialists of America, and Margaret Kimberly of the Black Agenda Report will talk about the black misleadership class and white supremacist violence. First, DSA. The Democratic Socialists of America, once a very tiny moribund formation, has grown more than tenfold in recent years, powered by an influx of mostly young members. For an overview, please check out my story on DSA on the New Republic magazine's website. And fairness dictates I disclose that I'm a member. DSA has done a lot to change the way we think and talk about politics, and they've helped elect a number of socialists to public office, ranging from marquee names like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to members of local flood control boards. DSA held its biennial convention in Atlanta over the first weekend in August. Here's Anderson Nattinger with more detail. He's a Madison, Wisconsin-based activist who is a delegate to the convention. Anderson Nattinger. People were expecting perhaps a contentious convention. How would you characterize it? Was it contentious?
Politically, I'd say it wasn't very contentious, but in terms of sorting out the organization, I think it was, yeah, there were some things to get worked out for sure.
What were the organizational disputes?
The biggest one was a financial question about how we distribute the resources that DSA has. It would make a constitutional amendment that every chapter, regardless of size, would get $100 flat per month. So there was a big back and forth. I'd say like the convention was kind of building to a showdown on this question. It was in a lot of ways a referendum on the build group, but also kind of this look at how we believe the needs of small chapters are working and what's the best way to address them.
And so what then was decided?
So it got voted down. It was actually, I think there was a lot of relief on it, to be honest, because part of what made it so tense was that there was like this procedural maneuver before convention. So that way the number of votes it needed was lower than any other constitutional amendment. So people were, you know, looking at it as like a bad faith move. And before we considered the question, somebody that was an author of the resolution called for that move to be rescinded. And so it was considered at the regular two-thirds margin.
You mentioned BILD, which is a caucus that doesn't call itself such. But what about that issue of factionalism within an organization, the caucuses? How do things play out? Some people are worried about the caucuses. They're divisive. Others say that it's good to have it all in the open. How did that play out, and how do you feel about it?
Well, I think that what was interesting is that for all of the policy questions, like the political issues of the day that needed to be considered, I didn't see that as so much a factional thing, right? Like most of the things that passed overwhelmingly. So I don't think that there's evidence that factions were just kind of playing for position there. Where the caucuses really weighed in was one, what resolutions made it to convention, right? Like that was a big preparation thing, is that caucuses had a substantial advantage in terms of deciding what was going to be debated. But more importantly, the organizational questions were the ones that fell along factional lines.
And one of those lines of cleavage is how much of a national organization to make it and how much of an organization of its locals. How did that dispute play out?
Well, that was interesting. So besides the financial part of it, right, where the major changes were basically all defeated. So I think that it ended up being kind of organizational status quo. What we're doing is going to continue to happen. We're going to tweak it a little bit. But, you know, there were a few constitutional amendments that would create these regional organizations. There were three kinds, right? They all had a similar kind of perspective. It was just a kind of like along a spectrum, right? So like, one of them would be creating an intermediary body called the National Organizing Committee, and that would have a lot of power. Then there was something that more like a coordinating thing that was regional organizing bodies. And the last one was the Libertarian Socialist sponsored Assembly of Locals, which would turn it much more into like a mandated Congress or something like that. And that one was voted down decisively.
Yeah, and so how does this the organization emerge? How strong a national organization is it, and you know, how much is it an organization of its locals?
In terms of the structure, like I said, nothing has changed, right? So what I think the major change is our attitude towards the national organization. The last 2 years, there's been a real crisis of confidence in DSA's national body. And I think that that's part of why these proposals came out for convention. But through the convention process, through the selection of a new leadership, I think that we've kind of put down the problems that we had for the last 2 years. And now there's some wiggle room for the new leadership to be able to demonstrate that, like, we know what we're going to try to do and we're going to address these questions, that there's some buy-in, some more buy-in from the locals that we're going to try this out.
And at the last convention 2 years ago, there was a lot of dispute over the presence of this guy, Danny Fatante, who worked for a cop union or something like that. And that was quite a bone of contention. What is the status of that body now, the National Political Committee, which is, what, the highest body in DSA, right?
In which regard?
I mean, is it what is the level of its prestige and its authority as it emerged from the convention?
Well, for one, there's no cops on it that we know, so that's good. But I think that it came out with a better representation of the different positions in DSA. So an early thing that happened at convention was a move to change how we selected the NPC. And that carried. And I actually voted against it, but I'm glad that it did pass in retrospect, right? Because I think that there's more confidence in the results of that election. So for the most part, you have like a majority of people that are in kind of a coalition that want a stronger organization, and a minority that are more along the network horizontal lines. So I think that everybody agrees that they've got their work cut out for them, but I think that that there's at least some desire to let them try.
And there's that question of, you know, decentralization versus centralization, you know, authority versus spontaneity, all those sorts of things have plagued the left for, you know, at least a century. So how did that work out? Was there any kind of consensus along those lines, or will this still be a point of contention for the organization going forward?
Well, there's no resolution definitively, right? Like, I think that that's a tension we're going to hold with us for a while, and it's going to be something that's going to require persuasion and experience. But something that I thought was really interesting when I was at the convention was that I met a lot of people that would be, like, a few years ago, I would have described them as, like, lifestyle anarchists. And they still were interested in a lot of the mutual aid kind of things, but they were also really interested in running the elections and these big mass campaigns, right? So that's different. And I think that there's an unevenness, but it's a good thing, right? That we're approaching a better sense of a collective approach here.
And then another one of these perpetual disputes is, you know, the old, to use the cartoon language, identity versus class dispute, which relates to DSA's own composition, its demographics. It's still a pretty white organization. How do those issues play at the convention?
I think that's what's been the most visible for a lot of people, in no small part because of Fox News and all those people kind of broadcasting some of the more dramatic moments. But for the most part, I'd say it was really respectful, right? I mean, we were kind of building the plane in midair, right? Like, we had to figure out what we were going to be doing. We were trying to listen to where people were coming from. And I thought it was actually a really positive thing that, like, most of the time I go to left conventions, there's usually some older guy that gets up and then, like, chastises everybody about how identity doesn't matter. That didn't happen once. It's hard, right? Like, people have got to negotiate this in real time. But I think that there was an appreciation that both things do really matter. And we haven't figured that out either. But I think that, you know, towards the end of convention, there were some people that were standing up saying, like, you've used my identity multiple times. And, like, you don't speak for me, right? Like, you can't make an entire monolith of an identity block. Like, we have different opinions, and this is political questions. It's not just the identitarian thing. So it was interesting, right? I think, like, it's going to continue to get sorted out, but trust is going to be the grease that helps the cogs turn.
And then what about you know, diversifying the membership, which is related to making the organization grow? What's the strategy for that?
Well, we did pass a resolution for targeted recruitment. that was useful part of a discussion that I think there was some recognition that DSA has really grown, really self-selected. And there was a proposal by the Collective Power Network to create...
Who are they?
They're a formation that is also not caucus. Their main criticism going into convention was that the organizational structure of DSA was going to need some reforming, so that way we could grow to be a mass socialist organization. So they put forward a proposal to talk about, you know, learning how to recruit and targeting people that we know should be in this organization, because if we just rely on self-selection, it's going to continue to be like downwardly mobile white people for the most part. So I think that was a really good move in the right direction.
And then another contentious issue is electoral politics in general, but also specifically the Sanders campaign and Medicare for All as the big national marquee issues versus more involvement in local electoral politics. What happened there?
Well, a lot. This, I think, was fairly significant. And I'll own my bias here because I wrote a resolution that was about our orientation to the Sanders campaign. But we had basically to figure out what are we going to do about the 2020 presidential election, that right now DSA is supporting Bernie Sanders. And, you know, it's going to be a very difficult campaign to get the nomination. And what are we going to do if he doesn't get awarded the nomination? So the convention voted that we would not endorse another Democrat for president.
We should emphasize that when DSA endorses someone, it's not just a paper stance. It's actually involves a commitment of resources and time.
Yeah, that's right. It would involve coordinating volunteer time. The big thing that the Sanders endorsement entailed was an independent expenditure campaign. So that way, DSA is putting forward materials, resources, volunteer hours, all kinds of things to try to support Sanders. So by voting to not endorse, we're saying that we're not going to commit any of those things. To clarify, though, it doesn't mean that we're mandating that no DSA member can vote, you know, however they feel like it or do what they want as an individual. It just means that our organizational stance is that we're not going to lend credibility to neoliberal Democrats.
I'm speaking with DSA convention delegate Andrew Sernatinger. And of course, then, you know, you get the critique from Democrats, don't you care about the kids in cages when you say something like that? Obviously, everyone does care about kids in cages, so that's a scurrilous charge. But what was the thinking behind this refusal to endorse any other Democrat behind Sanders?
Well, I'll speak for myself and say my thinking was that we know the politics of the politicians that will be running on the Democratic Party ticket, and we know that they don't align with ours. I mean, that criticism you just mounted right there about caring about kids in cages, the Democratic Party just gave Trump billions of dollars to continue this program, right? So I think that most average people know that the Democratic Party is bullshit, frankly, that the Democratic Party is, you know, it's not the kind of party we want to be involved in for a lot of reasons, and that we hold our nose or whatever. And you might want to do that as an individual, but I don't think it's something we should be doing as a socialist organization. So, you know, in terms of other things, we can look at them on all of the different policy positions they have and show why either they're aligned with the far right, enabled the far right, or whatever. And, you know, and we got into this position in the large part because the centrism of Obama really disappointed a lot of people. And now we're in a more polarized political situation. And the answer to that is not more centrism.
And this, the question of the relation to the Democratic Party in general is an important one. A lot of people, like Trotsky's friends, complain that DSA just doesn't understand that the Democratic Party is the graveyard of social movements, da-da-da-da-da-da. The relationship of DSA to the Democratic Party is a lot more, from my point of view, thoughtful and complicated than that kind of Trotsky's moralizing. So what emerged of the relation to the Democratic Party in the years going forward?
So outside of that stance of, you know, our conditional support for Sanders, we also included a petition for a correction on his foreign policy positions that DSA feels are lacking. But DSA also voted in favor of a position called class struggle elections. And that's an orientation to say, if we're going to be tactically using the Democratic Party ballot line, we should set some conditions for what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. And they laid out a document that I thought was very thoughtful, which included things like naming class enemies and using campaigns that we do actually want to win for office, but also have a movement orientation about seeing this not as as maneuvering around like a board or something like that, but how we can use this to extend movement building power. So I think that was a really good way to come out of this that affects national elections, but it also affects our approach to state and local ones as well.
Yeah, this issue of, you know, there's people often counterpose electoral politics and movement building, but it seems like most people in DSA, at least the ones I've talked to, don't find that those things in opposition, right? They feed each other.
Yeah, I think that basically is a common sense position that DSA was arriving at that just got formalized at this convention.
And then what about the, you know, party of our own question over the longer term? You know, the break, whether clean or dirty, with the Democratic Party. What's the long-term thinking on that relation?
That was a question that had some actual debate on, and I think that it's good that it was debated. So there was a proposal to strike language calling for an independent party at some time in the future. That measure failed, and we kept the language in the proposal for class struggle elections that said that we are eventually aiming for an independent party. The proposal for class struggle elections didn't specify when we want to make this break or whatever. It just said that ultimately that's our aim. There's a lot of flexibility, but I think there's also a recognition that we're in a conjuncture here that is unique. How long this is going to go on, we don't know, but ultimately we're in someone else's house here, and we're not going to be welcome forever.
Yes, it seems that way. And then the relationship with the labor movement. Movement, of course, is not always a word one uses to describe labor, but what about the relationship to organized labor?
First of all, I think that most DSA members don't have a strong grasp of how the American labor movement works. And I don't say that as like something to chastise. I think that that's the reality of the fact that less than 1 in 10 workers are in unions in the United States today. So why would we have such a good understanding, right? So mostly our approach to this question was to say that the work that DSA has been doing on labor is good and we want to continue it. There was a very split vote on what was called the rank and file strategy, which is an approach to working as union activists in the rank and file rather than as staff or some kind of labor official or something like that, and building the capacity of the union and trying to reform it, and ultimately use that as a basis for independent politics to build our socialist movement. That vote carried by 10 votes, which I think reflected that people don't fully understand it, but that they're open and interested to it. There's a lot of work that we have to do to educate about the labor movement and to make clear like what we will need to do to build a fighting labor movement, like put the movement in labor movement.
A complaint from some of my hyper-militant friends is that DSA is just too full of union bureaucrats to run a rank-and-file campaign effectively. Is that a problem?
I mean, it's an element, sure, but it's not the only one. I mean, I think that, you know, one reading of that resolution could have been people that were rank-and-file oriented versus, you know, bureaucrat oriented. But at the same time, a lot of the people that were voting for the rank-and-file strategy were themselves union staffers. So, you know, I don't know how much that carries. The actual activity that has been like celebrated in DSA is largely rank-and-file stuff. So the teacher strikes had some prominent DSA rank-and-file teachers involved. The San Francisco Anchor Steam union organizing campaign was also very much a rank-and-file effort. So, you know, I think it's an open question, right? Like, there's experience on both ends of this, and that's not settled.
And then eco-socialism, the Green New Deal, rather enthusiastically endorsed.
Oh, yeah, almost a consensus. I don't know that I saw a single no vote. I think that it reflects that we are incredibly anxious about the climate emergency, and we recognize that no one's doing anything and that it's going to take bold action by, you know, groups like ours to really win a Green New Deal.
But not Elizabeth Warren's green military, right?
Yeah, that was actually rejected, and I'm glad it was. So there was an amendment to the original resolution on a Green New Deal, saying that we would endorse the Red Deal put forward by the Red Nation, which is a socialist indigenous group in the United States, and also that we would reject green militarism, that that is, you know, fundamentally incompatible with our socialism.
Nathan Robinson, in his piece on the convention, noted the press conference of elected officials, which was incredibly diverse. You know, people all over the place, people of all demographics, who have elective office all across the country. DSA has become, certainly not enormous, but it has become a presence in a whole lot of communities, a whole lot of levels of government now, right?
Yeah. And I think that that's something that's really boosting the enthusiasm around the group. The Chicago Six Socialists won, I think, this last spring, and that was an enormous boon for DSA. The elections of Julia Salazar and AOC, obviously, in New York, and Tiffany Caban. So, I mean, there's obviously a lot of other people, but those are the most high-profile ones. And I think that people... You know, people are attracted to victory. You see something working, and you want a piece of that action.
Yeah, I mean, that story of the socialist city council member in Denver leading the charge to break the city's contracts with private prison operators, that's an impressive story. I mean, she really persuaded the entire body into her direction.
Yeah, and I think part of this, too, is that that a left, you know, if nothing else, anti-neoliberal message has been boxed out from American politics for the last 40 years. And now to see it break through, it's effective, at least in terms of you can't pretend that nobody wants this, right? That now it's a legitimate voice and you have to respond to a very popular demand coming out.
And then finally, how would you characterize how people felt when it's all over? How did people leave and go home? What kind of mood? What kind of thoughts for the future?
I think it was mostly very positive. I think that this rift that exists between, you know, people that are fighting for a stronger organization and people that want more disbursement is something that we're going to have to take really seriously. It's a significant minority of people that wanted to create a more diffuse organization. And we can't just look at it like, oh, they were beaten and need to like shut up. Like that's not the way it works. And I think we're going to have to really sit with the way that we're functioning as a collective organization, that just because a minority didn't get their way doesn't mean that we don't need them or that their perspectives aren't valid. So I think that that's going to be a lot of the work coming out, is people are excited that we had great political positions, great corrections to our policies that came out. There's a lot of energy about what kind of work we need to do. But I think that we need to make sure that we're really reforging the trust between us.
That was Andrew Cernatinger, a Madison-based member of DSA. In the interview, I mentioned the bits about local elected officials in Nathan Robinson's excellent article on the DSA Convention, A Gathering of Comrades, on the Current Affairs magazine website. It's worth reading a bit of to evoke the inspiring breath of the phenomenon. Nobody chanted or sang. It was just a short period in a windowless room where DSA-backed elected officials gathered to take questions from the media. And yet it was during those 45 minutes that I really felt something special was going on at the DSA National Convention. Something that might very well affect the contours of history. I'm not sure what it was that affected me so much, and these are still Robinson's words. I think it was just that there were so many of them, and they were so different from one another, and that they were from all over the place. They were of all races and genders, all of them socialists, and all of them serving in public office. A city councilor in Knoxville, Seema Singh. Other city council members and aldermen from Olympia, Billings, Somerville, Providence. A member of the Flood Control Board for Sacramento. State representatives, township trustees, judges, the first non-binary elected official in the country, Brandy Fortson of the Corvallis, Oregon School Board. The DSA handed out a document profiling the socialist elected officials in attendance. It ran 7 pages, and the ones who came are just a fraction of the total elected socialists in the U.S. There were so many that they couldn't all speak, but Mick Pappas, a Pennsylvania district judge, talked about his successful efforts to reduce eviction rates and all but eliminate cash bail in his courtroom. Ruth Buffalo of the North Dakota State Legislature has an incredible story. A Native woman, she ousted the Republican who sponsored the state voter ID law that controversially impacted Native Americans, and she beat him in a Republican-majority district. Now she has, according to DSA-provided bio, passed 7 bills through a Republican supermajority state house, including bills to support Native American rights and address the situation of missing and murdered Indigenous women. I was amazed at how much red state representation there was in the room, considering the media talking point that socialism can't win outside Queens. And that's the end of the excerpt from Nathan Robinson. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwin, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
He's gonna end up on the dirty boulevard. He's going out to the dirty boulevard. He's going down to the dirty boulevard. Room costs $2,000 a month. You can believe it, man, it's true. Somewhere a landlord's laughing till he wets his pants. No one dreams of being a doctor or a lawyer or anything. They dream of dealing on the dirty boulevard. Give me your hungry, you're tired, you're poor, I'll piss on them. That's what the statue of bigotry says. Your poor huddled masses, let's club them to death and get it over with and just dump them on the boulevard. Get them out on the dirty boulevard. Going out to the dirty boulevard. They're going down on the dirty boulevard. Going out. Outside, it's a bright night. There's an opera at Lincoln Center. Movie stars arrive by limousine. The Klieg lights shoot up over the skyline of Manhattan, but the lights are out on the mean streets. A small kid stands by the Lincoln Tunnel. He's selling plastic roses for a buck.
Now, some of Dirty Boulevard from Lou Reed's 1989 album, New York. The lines about what the statue of bigotry says sure seem relevant today. Next, Margaret Kimberly. When Trump attacked Elijah Cummings, a member of the House of Representatives whose district includes Baltimore, as coming from a rat-infested hellhole, people rightly attacked Trump for his bigotry. But should that let Cummings off the hook? Here's Margaret Kimberly, a senior columnist and editor at the Black Agenda Report, with some answers. First, Trump and Elijah Cummings. Trump is an appalling racist. There's no doubt about that. And his criticisms of Elijah Cummings and the city of Baltimore do not come from a place of sympathy or decency, just to get that out of the way first. But whenever Trump criticizes someone, you know, the instinct is just to get in line and defend him or her. But there are some issues with Elijah Cummings, aren't there?
Yeah, there are issues with Cummings and other members of the Congressional Black Caucus and the people who we refer to at Black Agenda Report as the Black misleadership class, who do not represent the interests of their constituents. They get and keep their especially elective offices because they toe the line. They don't oppose the Republicans any more than the rest of the Democratic Party do. They don't oppose Nancy Pelosi, who is just horrible. I mean, all she does is raise money and beat up progressives. That's it. That's what she does. And they go right along with her. And Baltimore is a city with some very serious problems. Of course, Trump doesn't care about that. He knows nothing about Baltimore or much of anything. But of course, because it's a majority Black city for now, of course, it's being gentrified, so that won't last forever. And the elected officials who hold office there are all Black. So he would talk about it being rat infested, no human being, meaning only Black people, no human being would want to live there, et cetera, et cetera. So, but he presents a contradiction when he says these things. First of all, Nancy Pelosi herself, I believe, plays a role in this, in these episodes where he goes on these rants, because she doesn't defend her members. Cummings is not particularly progressive. And Trump attacked him because Cummings is now chair of the House Oversight Committee. So he gets to, ask, what is his daughter's name? I'm blanking on her and her silly husband,
Ivanka. Ivanka collectively.
For documents when they're being investigated by Congress. And that's all he cares about. Everything is personal with Trump. I have to say this. At this point, it's kind of boring to me. And here's what I mean. Trump is who he is. He's this vile person, a racist, an angry, mean-spirited person. And so periodically, he's going to have these outbursts. And everybody comes along and says the obligatory things and try to outdo each other in saying how horrible he is. But nobody talks about the other issues involved. Why is Baltimore a mess? Baltimore is one of those cities that was deindustrialized. Baltimore is a mess because of white flight that happened over several decades. Now, white people want to come back in, so black people don't get mortgages that white people are getting. But we see the corruption involved in this city, in its police department. Baltimore has one of the worst police departments in the country.
Yeah, let's talk about that a moment, because you know, Freddie Gray, it was a black mayor and a black police chief, right, when Freddie Gray died.
Yes, and some of the cops who were charged with his killing were black. It was four or five of them. And, of course, he got no justice, no indictment, no nothing, no federal and that happened under Obama, no federal prosecution, nothing. And that same year, shortly, and then, of course, the community erupted in this, I'm going to call it a rebellion. But Elijah Cummings and other elected officials didn't say much. They criticized the people who rose up, called them rioters and so forth. And, you know, it's been a while since we've had situations like this. But I believe these so-called riots, these rebellions, as I prefer to call them, they always erupt over some injustice, generally police brutality cases. And the job of these leaders should be to express the outrage of their people. It should be to make the demand, because that is one of the reasons people rebel, because there's no one representing them who's in a position of authority. The police are known for their corruption, for planting weapons on people. There's a man named Keith Davis who was convicted right before this Trump Cummings controversy. The police shot Keith Davis, and I'm quite confident, and many others believe, they then framed him for a murder that he had nothing to do with. And it took them four court cases in order to get a conviction. And this is something that the rest of the elected officials have also been silent about. So I would hope that we can say that Trump is who he is, denounce him when he needs to be denounced, but we don't have to defend his targets. His targets are not always people worthy of defense.
This reminds me of welfare reform. You know, when Bill Clinton and all were going after welfare and trying to end it. Welfare as it was in the United States was a terrible system. It was cheap and mean and intrusive and humiliating. Yet, because it was under attack from the right, you know, we were in the position of having to defend it. And this is a similar thing. When Trump shoots off his mouth, people feel like they have to defend his targets. But, you know, these are terrible things. We have to be able to admit that they're terrible things.
Right. But what happened with Clinton? He made welfare even worse. Public assistance was a right. From the time of FDR, for 60 years, people had the right to get public assistance in some form or fashion. But by turning it over to the states, many of whom hate poor people, especially states where most of the poor people are black, public assistance was whittled down and whittled down and whittled down. And there are states where people hardly get anything. So welfare is even worse than it was before. The poverty rate has increased for a number of reasons. Overall, wages haven't gone up. Living wage jobs have decreased. But to have the safety net torn up the way it was under Bill Clinton has just had a devastating effect. So the critique of welfare could have been made. I think welfare should have been more generous, frankly. But it was easy to go along with the Democrat. And it was the sort of thing a Democrat could get away with that a Republican could not.
Well, it's like privatizing Social Security. Only a Democrat could get away with that.
Oh, sure. Privatizing Social Security, welfare reform, NAFTA, the trade deals, all of these things, they bailing out the banks. These are things that they wait for Democrats to do because they get cover because they're not Republicans. And it's disgraceful, really, that so few people spoke up against. Yeah, so Clinton got away with doing many terrible things, and Democrats went along with him where they would not have gone along with a Republican who did the same thing.
Let's return to this, you know, the issue of the Black mixed leadership class and the Congressional Black Caucus generally. Who do they represent then? Who do they answer to? I mean, who is their sponsor, and who do they feel like they have to represent?
Well, corporate interests, like the rest of them. You know, for a long time, they were left alone. The Congressional Black Caucus was known as the conscience of the Congress. They were the most left-leaning members of the House because their constituents were the, and are, the most left-leaning people in the country. And corporate interests tried to figure out ways to influence them as well. They tried running Black Republicans, and nobody fell for that. And then they realized, well, we got to buy them off too. So they are now as beholden to corporate interests as everybody else. And when they step out of line, they're defeated. People like Cynthia McKinney and a couple of others were suddenly their opponents were able to raise a lot of money. And so the message, if in case anybody didn't get the message, it was, you're going to be like everybody else from now on, or we're going to make sure you're defeated.
And then at the urban level, you know, the cities like Baltimore, the mayors, the police chiefs, I mean, what, how do these folks stay in power, even if they don't represent their constituents?
They stay in power because they're the ones who get to raise money. Then once they're in, they have the power of incumbency. It's difficult to dislodge these people. They're basically, these are like jobs for life. Unless they die or go to jail, they have these jobs as long as they want them. You'd have to have really strong political organizing that can defeat the money. And these people have, they all stick together, they endorse one another, the corporate media endorse them. So it's difficult for newcomers who are really different to come up and to dislodge them. They end up sticking around. And nobody, because no one else is able to really confront them and have a good chance of getting them out of office, people just sort of keep voting for them. And they know what to say. They know how not to offend people. But actually, they cause a lot of apathy. So the turnout is not high in their district. So they win election with, you know, with sometimes very small numbers of people turning out. Sometimes, in the case where of, let's say, Stacey Abrams running for governor in Georgia, there is a huge turnout. But by and large, these races don't get a lot of people. But it doesn't matter because they manage to keep anybody else out who can challenge them.
Well, Stacey Abrams is an interesting case. She's Yale Law School, Center for American Progress, kind of a neoliberal, right? But she gets this reputation as an insurgent.
Sure. She was invited to Bilderberg. I don't know if you knew that, but so they're grooming her for other things. But, you know, Georgia is so racist, and it's a state where they excel in stealing Black people's votes. She doesn't have to do much to be seen as this, what word am I searching for, to be seen as someone who's going to fight the status quo. And in fact, she's very status quo. And just another neoliberal Democrat. Now, would she be better than the awful people who run Georgia? She would, but who knows who she would represent? It's, you know, with these Democrats, what do we get? We often get people who, the most we can say for them is that they're not racist. And she's a Black person, so no, she's not an anti-Black racist. But would she really fight for the interests of Black people in Georgia? So probably not. That's not how you raise money. It's not how you get on the ballot. So it's a terrible thing that the race was, I'm sure, stolen from her. I'm confident in saying that. But people like her are not, they're not the answer to our problems any more than any other Democrats are.
I'm speaking with Margaret Kimberly of the Black Agenda Report. Of course, you know, it's not, we don't have to worry about votes being stolen by anybody but the Russians, right? They're the ones who are responsible.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. Last week, it was the hashtag was Moscow Mitch, because Mitch McConnell opposed a bill that would bring more accountability to the ballot. And these electronic voting machines have been used to steal elections. And he's opposed to it because Republicans steal votes, mostly from black people. It's got nothing to do with Russia. But this is what happens. And Russiagate has done such terrible damage to the country that nobody talked about the reason he's against it. It's because the Republicans won't be able to steal votes from black people. It's got nothing to do with Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, sometimes it just astonishes me that Democrats don't even have the partisan fervor to go after somebody like Mitch McConnell. They'll apply this Moscow Mitch nickname to him rather than like go after the fact that he's stealing votes from Democrats.
But Democrats never complain. I mean, the presidency was stolen from Al Gore. I believe it may have been stolen from Hillary Clinton, too. The margin of votes in those states that flipped and gave Trump the Electoral College victory was very small. It was 70 some odd thousand votes. I'll round up and say 80,000 votes. We don't know if he really got those votes. There are stories of votes in Michigan. She lost Michigan, we're told, by 10,000 votes. But then we hear about votes in black neighborhoods that weren't counted and more than 10,000 of them. So she may have won Michigan at the very least. But they go along to get along. They want to be part of the permanent government. And speaking up would also mean speaking up for black people, the people they depend on the most to get votes, but the people they do not want to be identified with.
Yeah, just shut up and just vote for me.
Yeah, essentially, you're right.
And now, to change the subject somewhat, yet another white racist murder. And, you know, it's tempting to blame Trump. He certainly has contributed to an intensification of racist violence. But this is an old American story. It's not like it just started in 2017.
Oh, absolutely. I believe that Trump has inspired some of these killings. I remember when shortly after he was, or before he was, it was January 2017, a man in Quebec murdered people, shot people to death in a mosque. And I remember at the time saying, this guy was inspired by Trump. And sure enough, it turned out that he was. So I'm not going to say that he has no responsibility. In fact, the guy in the El Paso shooting spoke openly of his admiration for Trump and his anti-immigrant stance, and he didn't like Hispanic people. And of the 22, now it's up to 22 victims, a couple of people have passed away since the shooting, and I believe 19 of them had Spanish last names. And El Paso is right on the border, I'm sure. If you shot anybody, if you shot a large crowd of people in El Paso, you would kill mostly Latinos. The case in Dayton, Ohio, is a little less clear what his motivation was in shooting his own sister, although most of the victims in that the bar were black people. Six of the nine victims were black. But this did not just happen. There have been mass killings periodically. For the last 20 or so years, you know, we all remember Columbine was the first one, and Virginia Tech, and the Orlando nightclub, and Sandy Hook, the school in Connecticut. So this didn't start with him, and I'm certainly not going to say that there wouldn't be, if he weren't the president, that there wouldn't be any more mass shootings. I can't say that. But I think we also have to admit that white supremacy is it's just pervasive. And it's not just people proclaiming their racism either. After these shootings, Congressman Stephen Cohen from Tennessee, he tweeted and then deleted the tweet. If you want an assault weapon, you should enlist in the army and, you know, carry it around in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he deleted it because obviously he was saying it's okay to kill people, kill some brown skinned people someplace else in the world. That's white supremacy. And Mayor Pete, he said something similar. I carried an assault weapon, but nobody should carry one here. Or I didn't carry a.
It's okay to kill Afghans. Just
yes, essentially, yes. But that's white supremacy. The fact that we have this huge military budget, the fact that there are invasions and occupations and attempts at regime change, that's also white supremacy. And people don't, even liberals don't oppose it that much, if at all. So I'm less inclined to just point fingers at Trump. And it's interesting, in the case in El Paso, the police arrested the shooter and didn't lay a finger on him, didn't put him in a chokehold, didn't shoot him, didn't beat him, didn't slap him around, nothing. And he didn't shoot at any police either. So that tells me.
But he wasn't selling cigarettes illegally.
Well, yeah, there you go. So that tells me that he felt a kinship with the cops and the cops with him too. And that's a harder conversation to have than to just say that people are racist or they're psychos or they're racist psychos. And it goes beyond Trump.
And people never draw any connection between, you know, these domestic killings and this vast machinery of imperial violence that we have.
Oh, no, it starts at the top. That tells people that killing is okay. And this, you know, this fetish, this obsession with the troops, support the troops, and they get to board the plane first, and, you know, and thank you for your service. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Every baseball game, you know, the seventh inning stretch now is a celebration of imperial violence.
It is. It is. And that you can't have that not filter down to the broader society. And police killings, there's still nothing that's been done. We still have an average of 3 people every day killed by the police. That's hate crime. The biggest hate criminals are police across the country. And they should be referred to as such. And there's a clear racial divide there. Most white people are a lot less likely to protest police killings because it generally is not them. There are white people killed by the police, but not in this disproportionate percentage that black people are. So those are the things, all the things that should have to be discussed if we want to talk about white supremacy and what inspires racist violence.
Well, you know, I'm an affluent, educated white person. And the worst experience I ever had with a cop was that a guy was rude to me at the New York State Thruway when he gave me a ticket. So for like most white people, just don't have bad experiences with cops. I guess, you know, if you're poor, you know, you might have that experience, but people who are better off and white people just have no bad experiences with cops, so they just don't even speak to them personally.
Yes, absolutely, and that's not a coincidence. So it's easy, and I'm not saying people aren't upset and aren't outraged about these shootings, and, you know, when it's so many people at once, it's easy to focus on it, but not to focus on the large number of gun shooting victims that we have in this country. The fact that there are so many guns, and now the people, I was reading that over the decades, a smaller and smaller number of people own guns, but the people who have them have a lot of them. And that speaks to something that's very frightening to me. I get the feeling there are people who are just waiting to get permission to go kill other people and to be unleashed. But you're right about the police. They're the modern day slave patrol, and their job, they see their job, and I think most white people see their job, as keeping black people under physical control. And that's where we still are. And I know when Eric Garner, the Trump Justice Department, said there wouldn't be any federal prosecution. And people right away said, well, of course, Trump wouldn't do it. But how different was Obama? I believe there was one federal prosecution of a cop in the 8 years that Obama was in office.
Well, it's not like Bill de Blasio did all that much either.
Well, no, he didn't. And now they might fire the cop, which, I mean, that's the best we can hope for. The man was murdered on film. The only person in jail for it is the guy who did the video.
That's just utterly scandalous.
The police set him up, and he's the one in jail for some trumped-up charge.
Well, and finally, you know, every time there's one of these mass shootings, and it seems like they happen a couple of times a week now, it's always the same thing. It's mental illness, and it's too many guns. What about, you know, the gun control issue? How do you feel about that? Is that the solution to this problem?
Well, I think it's part of it. There's no reason for a civilian to have an assault weapon. There's just no reason. You know, if you're people are hunters, I mean, do you use those to hunt deer? I'm sorry, or marksmen or whatever. So I think those weapons of that type should be banned. There's no reason for anybody to have them. but it's a cultural issue, as we know. There are parts of the country where it's a non-starter to talk about gun control of any kind. And, you know, and Democrats play this game, too. I remember, I think it was when Gore was running, but I'm sorry, I'm getting confused about the year. But at any rate, people said, you know, that Democrats lost in certain regions of certain states because Democrats were connected with gun control. And so it should not be a Democratic Party issue. And so there's cowardice, there's political cowardice. That you either have places like Texas where you can take a gun into the Texas State House. States like Texas and Ohio are both open carry states. So much for the argument that, you know, if everybody got to carry a gun, there wouldn't be any mass shootings. That certainly wasn't true. But so half the country thinks it's okay and the other half are afraid to do anything.
I was Margaret Kimberly, a senior columnist and editor at the Black Agenda Report. That's it from me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, another song from Lou Reed's 1989 album, New York, Sick of You. The names Trump and Giuliani are still plaguing us 30 years later. Till next week, bye.
They ordained the Trumps and then he got the mumps. He died being treated at Mount Sinai. And my best friend Bill died from a poison pill. Some wire doctor prescribed for stress. My arms and legs are shrunk, the food all has lumps. They discovered some animal no one's ever seen. He was an inside trader eating a rubber tire after running over Rudy Giuliani. They say the president's dead, no one can find his head. He's been missing now for weeks, but no one noticed it. He had seemed so fit, I'm sick of it. I'm sick of you. I'm so sick of you. Bye, bye, bye.